Welcome back. You guys are doing great on attendance. You know it's week 8 of an Old Testament study, right? You're not supposed to be here anymore. Thank you for continuing to come. I'm so glad that you came back because I couldn't wait to get here. I got a haircut. I don't know if you noticed. I thought that would be ironic considering that we were doing the Samson story. I thought you'd enjoy that. And it was Holly that did it, so you can blame her if you think I should have kept it unshorn for our meeting today. So it's been a while since we met, and so I kind of want us to just get our bearings again on where we were when we last met, and that was with the story of Jephthah, because we need to understand, right, the trajectory of where the story is going if we're going to understand the Samson cycle the way that we're supposed to. And you guys know we're going to spend 2 weeks covering Samson because, man, he deserves it. There is so much rascally business. We would not want to limit it all to just 1 week, and there's so much more description of what happens in the Samson story than we saw with those earlier judges. And we said that's the pattern that we were going to see here, that as the narrative moves toward its conclusion, and we're on judge number 12 now, what we're going to see is an increasing focus on the personal behavior of the judge versus those earlier ones where we had a few details, but the bigger focus was on how that cycle was taking place. And we're seeing the cycle already begin to break down. But you know that Abimelech was the hinge for the book. He was the week where we saw what an anti-judge looked like. And then one who was self-appointed and who just kind of did everything according to his own theories of management, which was not good for the nation of Israel. And then we moved to the story of Jephthah, which was a real bell ringer, where Jephthah ends up sacrificing his daughter, and he makes a rash vow, a vow that did not honor the Lord in the first place, and then feels that he needs to honor it. And we saw in that story, one of the things that I loved about that story was that you can already see God working something for good that was completely evil in the fact that the daughter's death becomes a remembrance among a forgetful people. That is the Lord making redemption in the midst of what is a terrible, godless scene. You see that begin to happen. So that already we see these little glimmers of hope even within these darkest days of Israel. And then we moved pretty quickly through those three judges, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, who showed us that according to the number of sons and daughters and donkeys that were in their accounts in the years that they reigned, it appears that they were following this model that we saw started by Gideon of, I'm not a king, but I live like a king. And so that brings us up to where we are with the story of Samson. Samson is judge number 12, and we're going to see what his philosophy of leadership looks like. He is our final judge in the cycle. After we get through these 2 weeks where we talk about him, we move into sort of almost like a postscript in the book where we will see kind of this is what life then looks like in Israel when everyone does what is right in their own eyes. And so Samson leads us into that, because we see that Samson is already doing what is right in his own eyes. So we're going to be in Judges chapter 13, and we're just going to start in verse 1 and do what we do. We're going to walk through it. So it says, starting in verse 1, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So this is the familiar cycle, and I asked you to start filling in your chart this week, your little cycle that's in your homework. And did you have some trouble with that? Yeah, there are big pieces that are missing. And the biggest piece that is missing, and the most significant piece for our study this week and next, is the piece that is missing between verse 1 and verse 2 of chapter 13. And that is where Israel should have done what? Cried out to the Lord, right? But they don't cry out to the Lord. And then what we see in the Samson story is that not only do they not cry out, but the reason that they don't cry out is because they are living happily under Philistine oppression. Like whatever this oppression looks like, they have made their peace with it. And we'll see that even more so in the two chapters that we cover next week. But we already see that in this the two chapters we have at hand this week. So they do not even cry out to the Lord. So unaware are they of the situation that they have fallen to, that they have made their peace with living in the land of Canaan, in the midst of the Canaanites rather than the Canaanites living in the midst of them. They did not drive them out, and now we see what that's going to look like. So then we move into verse 2. And 40 years, I pointed out in your homework, 40 years, by far the largest amount of oppression. And next week we'll take a look more at that. that, but it's twice, it's more than twice the length of oppression that they have had in the entire book of Judges. In the Deborah cycle, we saw 18 years of oppression, after which there was a prolonged period of peace. So 40 years, and then we go to verse 2. There was a certain man of Zorah, of the tribe of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore, be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child should be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines." So we open with this birth announcement, and it is brought by an angel to a barren woman. And this is a formula that we have seen elsewhere in the scripture. This is what happens with Sarah, and it happens to Hannah. It happens other places as well. And it echoes a future point in which an angel will come and make an announcement, not to a woman who is barren, but to a woman who has never known a man, to the Virgin Mary, and she will be told that she is going to have a child who will deliver his people. And so already in the Samson narrative, we're seeing these inklings of, okay, this is pointing us toward the work of Jesus, but it will end up doing so as an antithetical image rather than as one that reinforces the work of Christ. And so she's barren and had no children. I like how it's mentioned there twice, just in case you missed the point. She's barren and had no children. So in this culture, of course, being barren is the worst fate that a woman can have befall her. And so the angel gives her doubly good news, because not only does he say that she will conceive in verse 3, but that she will bear a what? A son. And that's what they want. They want sons in that culture. That's the best thing that you can hear. And so interestingly, we're going to see this play back and forth between Manoah and his unnamed wife. And you might think that because his wife is not named, that is somehow making her less than in this narrative. But if you had to point to which of these two parents was the one who's sharper, which one would you point to? The wife, right? And what we're going to see is, you know, I've told you, keep an eye on the women, right? And in the story of Samson, we're going to have four women who are really important to the story. And Samson's mother is the first one. And so you'll notice here that it's almost comical. I would say that it is comical, this back and forth between Manoah and his wife and Manoah and the angel. And Manoah is presented to us as a well-meaning but sort of clown-like character in this passage. And the wife comes across as the one who is rational, thinking things through, paying attention to what's being said. So let's see how this all plays out. So she is told that she will conceive and bear a son, and she's told that twice, actually. So she's reassured twice, and then she's told these requirements that will be placed not just on the child, but on her as well as his mother. And so basically, this is a child who is going to take on this Nazarite set-apart status for his entire life. And this is unusual, because you looked in Numbers and you read about the Nazarite vow, and it was something that was taken on for a time period, okay? And so the hair growth piece of it was because it would indicate how long the vow had been in place, the length of a person's hair. So it was like a time marker. You could tell how long someone had been under a Nazarite vow by how long their hair was. I was trying to think about what Samson must have looked like to have never had. All I could think was that Rapunzel movie, you know, and where she's just lugging her hair around the whole time. So I don't know. Like, I don't know. I know hair kind of breaks off at some point if you have it on there long enough. So I can't imagine that it was, you know, just endlessly long. But my word, he must have had some dreads to end all dreads. And you can imagine that by the time we start seeing him go a-courting with the Philistine woman, he's young, you know, he's probably 18 or 20. And so however much hair quantity you can grow over that period of time is what this guy would have had. So not only was he to be set apart, but he was set apart in a way that was visibly discernible to everyone around him. Now, if I were to ask you, based on what you know of Samson from the story, was he a cool kid or a kid who's on the outside, the fringes? Where would you put him? He's a cool kid. And how much does the cool kid like to look different from everybody around? You know, I don't know how he dealt with this idea of everybody who looks at me thinks that I am a freak, but it sounds like he ended up turning it into something that made him even more of a cool kid than someone who was weird. So he's the kid who makes dreads awesome and everybody else want to get them, I guess. So we can see that God is miraculously raising up a deliverer in the way that the angel of the Lord comes and speaks to Manoah's wife. And we also see a parallel here to Gideon's calling to be a judge, where the angel of the Lord also appeared, and we'll have similarities in the offering and all of that that we're going to walk through as we go through the text. And so he tells her, and this is significant, in verse 5, he says, "No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb," which is unusual. We don't hear that anywhere in Numbers, that that's something that would be done. "And he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines." Did you catch that? It doesn't say he shall save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. It says he will make a beginning of it. And you know how the story ends. Does he or does he not make a beginning of delivering from the Philistines? He actually does make a beginning of it, but it is in spite of himself rather than because of himself. And that's what we get to watch unfold in this story. But he is consecrated from conception to the Lord. And so then it says in verse 6, "Then the woman came and told her husband, 'A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God. Very awesome. I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. But he said to me, "Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. So then drink no wine or strong drink, and eat nothing unclean, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" So how well does she encapsulate the message that the angel has given her? She nails it, right? She tells them everything that happens in the conversation. And you notice that she points out that he is to be a Nazarite from the time that he is born till when? The day that he dies. Now, ironically, it will be the breaking of his Nazarite vow that brings about the day that he dies. But he is to be consecrated from the beginning to the end, from the Alpha to the Omega of his life. He is going to be set apart and sanctified for the purpose of beginning to make a deliverance of his people. So again, these pointing toward the picture of Christ that is coming in a future time to fully deliver his people. So to the day of his death versus a period of time. And it's interesting, too, that the angel makes a point to say, "You shall eat nothing unclean." That's where we start to get an indication of just exactly what the state is of Israel living among the Philistines. Should an Israelite woman need to be told, by the way, don't eat anything unclean during your pregnancy or any other time? No. She should not have to be told that, but the angel is making sure, hey, listen, things are so haywire around here. Everybody's eating hot dogs and bacon and whatever they want. I need you to focus. Don't eat anything unclean. So he's pulling it back around to, I'm calling you to faithfulness to the God of Israel in the way that you handle this pregnancy and then also in the way that you're going to raise a child. So here comes Manoah, verse 8. "Then Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, 'O Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come again to us and teach us what we are to do with the child who will be born.'" Okay, didn't the angel already tell your wife this information? Okay, verse 9. "And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again to Manoah?" What does it say? "To the woman as she sat in the field." Did you catch that? The Lord is like, hey, I'm doing this on my terms, okay? And like, they aren't really sure yet that the woman is more certain than her husband that this is from the Lord, but he's still saying a man of God. He's not really sure what's going on. So it says that the angel comes again to the woman as she sat in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So the woman ran quickly and told her husband, "Behold, the man who came to me the other day has appeared to me." And Manoah arose and went after his wife and came to the man and said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to this woman?" Okay, she said it was the man who spoke to her. Do you hear how this guy is reacting to his wife? And he said, "I am." And Manoah said, "Now, when your words come true, what is to be the child's manner of life and what is his mission?" And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat of anything that comes from the vine, neither let her drink wine and strong drink or eat any unclean thing. All that I commanded her, let her observe." What does the angel do? I already told your wife. basically is what he's saying here. So what is Manoah doing? He's wanting to manage things. He's wanting to be the guy who's in charge, and let me just make sure. But he's totally disregarding the words of his wife, and he wants to hear it straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And so here we see added this other prohibition: neither let her drink wine or strong drink or eat any unclean thing or anything that comes from the vine. So she's not even allowed to have grapes or grape juice or anything like that. It's like just give a wide berth to anything vague resembling an alcoholic beverage. I'm thinking if she's married to him, she could use a drink. Verse 15, Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "Please let us detain you and prepare a young goat for you." And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "If you detain me, I will not eat of your food, but if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to the Lord." For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. Do you see what just happened here? So the angel of the Lord, who we should read as the voice of God speaking to Manoah, refuses to have a meal with Manoah. Why would that be? Because in this culture, to sit down and break bread together was to say, there is shalom, there is peace between you and me, between your house and my house. And is there peace between the Lord and Israel? No, not right now. And so what does God essentially say? He says, if you will approach me, let it be with a burnt offering and a sacrifice, because that is the way you come before the person who is visiting you today. So he holds him to a right term in regard to how he should be related to. Verse 17, and Manoah said to the, let's see how Manoah responds to basically having his hospitality denied. Verse 17, Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "What is your name, so that when your words come true, we may honor you?" Can you hear the irony now in that statement? Who the heck do you think you are? Is a little of what is being communicated there. What is your name? And if you're familiar with other stories in Scripture where people have asked the angel of the Lord, "What is your name?" Think Jacob wrestling with the angel. Why do we want to know someone's name? In this culture, particularly where a name tells us something about a person, knowing someone's name was a way of having some measure of their character, of who they are. And so Manoah basically is asserting the desire to have some measure of this person, to want to have a measure of control. And interesting, the response is this in verse 18. And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?" And we read wonderful and we think, amazing, fantastic, fabulous. That is not what that word is communicating to us. It means my name is something to be wondered at, in the sense that it is beyond your ability to comprehend. It is fabulous. It is the stuff of fables. It is marvelous. It is to be marveled at, because it is beyond your searching out. Why do you ask my name? You cannot quantify who I am. Many of us, because we're women and we've been in women's ministries and Bible studies, are familiar with Psalm 139. Psalm 139, 6, which tells us that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And we read that and we think, God thinks I'm wonderful. But what is that text saying? It is not telling you something about you. It is telling you something about your Creator, that He is wonderful. He is beyond searching out. That the one who knitted you together, you who are a set of limits and boundaries and are quantifiable and utterly knowable, that the one who knit you together is unknowable. He is unbound. He is beyond your tracing out. He is wonderful. And that is what is said to Manoah here. You don't control me. I'm in charge. And even though we're about to read a story where it looks like God is not in charge, in fact, God is moving behind the story the entire time that it is playing out. So verse 19 says this, "So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it on the rock to the Lord, to the one who works wonders." There it is. "And Manoah and his wife were watching. And when the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord went up in the flame of the altar. Now Manoah and his wife were watching, and they fell on their faces to the ground." It's an appropriate response. They understand now who it is that they have been dealing with. Verse 21, "The angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and to his wife." So this is very similar to the Gideon account, right? And it says in verse 21, "Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord." Verse 22, "And Manoah said to his wife, 'We shall surely die, for we have seen God.'" This is a rational response unless you consider everything else that has just happened, right? And his wife is going to point him toward what in the Gideon account the Lord tells Gideon himself. I'm not going to kill you. I have a plan for you. I've just told you I have a plan for you. And so his wife now is coming back to him and saying, as the voice of reason, dude, he just said that we were supposed to raise this child in a very particular way. Why would he kill us? But his wife said to him, verse 23, if the Lord had meant to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering at our hands or shown us all these things or now announced to us such things as these. So she speaks the truth and calms him the heck down. Verse 24, and the woman bore a son, and she called his name Samson. And did you notice who it was that gave him his name? It's his mother, it's not his father, which I think is another commentary on sort of how this marriage functioned. And Samson means sunny or brightness. So he's the sunny boy. He's this bright, lovely child. And what's interesting is that the reference to the sun in his name is thought by many commentators to show a sensitivity, an awareness, a receptiveness to the worship of the sun god in the pagan culture in which they were living. So it's actually sort of a troubling name in and of itself, because it shows that even though Manoah and his nameless wife are at the outset well-meaning and intend to do what the Lord has asked of them, that they too are living in a culture to which they are susceptible. So it says, Sonny boy grew and the Lord blessed him. And the spirit of the Lord began to stir in him in Mahanadan between Zorah and Eshtaol. And so we hear that the spirit of the Lord begins to stir in him. And this is the hard thing about this story, is that we see the spirit of the Lord operating through Samson in a miraculous way to give him external gifts. But what does he seem to lack throughout the story? Any kind of internal barometer to go along with them. So it seems possible, in fact, I would say that this is sometimes the case, that the Lord gifts someone prodigiously in some outward gift that can be of service to the body of believers or to those that they know. But when there is no internal sense of love for the Lord and a production of the fruits of the Spirit, then those gifts are squandered. But they do not go entirely to waste, because the Lord intends to use us either because of ourselves or in spite of ourselves. And so we end chapter 13 with expectation and even with hope. I mean, heaven forbid that we get this far into the book of Judges and still be optimistic, yet we still feel it, don't we? We're like, maybe this is the one. And that's what we're intended to think. That's the way the nation of Israel should have shaped their thinking over years and years and years. Maybe this is the one. Maybe this is the one. Maybe this is the one. And yet, ironically, when the one finally comes, they say, are you the one, or should we expect another? Or they just don't see it at all. But the Lord works in spite of them, if not through them, even in that. So now we enter into chapter 14. And you'll notice that we lead off with the phrase, Samson went down to Timnah. And I don't know if you caught this, but that phrase, went down, happens 5 different times in this chapter. You know why? Because it's about to go down. It is going downhill. And if you pay attention to that throughout the Old Testament narratives, you'll notice a lot of times these discussions of whether people are going up or going down, and where they are fixing their eyes, whether it's on something here or on something up here. And those are significant cues for us to pay attention to the action in the narrative. So verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1, we see the first reference to went down. Samson went down to Timnah, and Timnah was a border town between Judah and the land that was occupied by the Philistines, but it's probably occupied by the Philistines at this time, but it would have been a sort of a fractious place right there on this border. If there was going to be any kind of friction between the Philistines and the Israelites, this would be a good place for it to start. And so does Samson want any friction with the Philistines? Actually, no. He wants to go marry one of them. But what does the Lord want? The Lord wants there to be friction with the Philistines. No one has cried out to him. He wants them to see that crying out is what they should have done. So Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Then he came up and told his father and mother, I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. There was an article last week in the, I think it was in the New York Times, and it was asked the question, are we raising narcissists? And it went through all of these, like, how do you speak to your child? Are you talking to your child in a way that turns them into a narcissist when they grow up? And I'm thinking, turns them into a narcissist? Aren't we all born narcissists? I mean, that's how we come out is, hey, it's the me show. And then we have to be convinced by our parents and by people who love us, no, 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 it can't be the me show. That's not going to work. Like, it's okay when you're a newborn and about through age 2.5 and 3, but at some point you need to begin to see that there's something bigger out here than you. But apparently, Samson Sunny Boy didn't get there. So he says, get her for me as my wife. Verse 3, but his father and mother said to him, is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you must go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? So notice here, this is an important reference. So his parents seem to have enough awareness of the law to know that this is not okay. He should not go and marry a Philistine woman. And they even point out that they are the uncircumcised Philistines. And that's a good reminder for you and me, because we don't want to read this text to say, we don't want you to marry someone of another race or nationality. What is the issue? We don't want you to marry someone of another what? Religion. That's the issue here. And that is still the issue for believers today. You are a fool if you think you can be yoked to someone who does not love your God and that that's going to go well for you. And so they're saying, these are uncircumcised Philistines. They don't worship our God. And Samson said, thanks, Mom and Dad. Thank you so much. I love that we're at a stage in our relationship where I can hear your wisdom and respond to it. Bless you, my mother and father. No, he says what actually most of us would think a guy in his late teens, early 20s would say. He says, said to my father, get her for me, for she is right in my eyes. Now, I think when we read that, we're like, oh, in your eyes, right? Like she's smoking hot. Is that what this is about? No, that's actually not what is communicated in that phrase, in my eyes, because you're going to see it later where it talks about how all of Israel did what was right in their own eyes. And it means this is what seemed right to him. Based on his own wisdom, this is what seemed like the best choice for him. And the scriptures tell us faithfully that there is a way which seems right to man. But what is the end of it? The end thereof is death. The end thereof is death. And in Samson's case, that's a pretty accurate summary there. So starting in verse 4, his father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. So here you read this little section in verse 4, and you're like, oh, wait a minute. The Lord wants him to marry the Philistine woman? Like, maybe Samson is being godly in the fact that he wants to go break God's law and marry that. Hold on. There's smoke coming out of my ears. What do I do with this? And what we're seeing here is that the Lord intends to use Samson's sinfulness to accomplish his ends. And what are his ends? He wants there this, he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. The he is referring to God, not to Samson. Samson is not seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. He is seeking to live among them peaceably and marry one of their women. The Lord is seeking an opportunity against the Philistines because the Philistines are ruling over Israel. And so does this mean that Samson was right to marry this woman? No, it means that the Lord, knowing Samson's heart, intends to work through him in his sinfulness. Starting in verse, and praise God. Can I just say that I am thankful that the Lord does this because he has had to do this with me on many occasions. On many occasions, I want to know that he can redeem my foolishness because there are many days when I say this is right in my own eyes and I press forward with something that I ought not to. So verse 5, then Samson did what? He went down. Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah. Did you notice that? We already have a little ooh-hoo warning flag. Where are you hanging out? Oh, in the vineyards? Awesome. Good choice. So he's already doing what we've seen other people do. This is like Lot, who casts his tent, pitches his tent toward Sodom. This is that whole flirting with the boundary lines. Oh, what? We're just hanging out here. We're not going to have a glass of wine. Oh, is there a tasting bar over there? Oh, well, that's okay, because we're just going to sit over here. So they're at the vineyards of Timnah, and it says, and behold, this is where it starts to get weird, right? It was already pretty weird. And behold, a young lion came toward him roaring. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. And although he had nothing in his hand, he tore the lion in pieces as one tears a young goat. Okay, this story, this made me laugh. Because first of all, Okay. The Spirit of the Lord rushes on him. So what we see here is, where does the lion come from? Why does the lion suddenly interject itself into the story? Because the Lord sent the lion, right? What is he doing? He's giving Samson an opportunity to understand that he is strong, that the Lord is empowering him. But I think we're going to see that Samson isn't like, wow, thank you, Lord, for strengthening me so I could tear up the lion. Samson's like, check out these guns, right? I mean, Samson, he's all through the story, he's like, I am awesome in this place. And so the lion comes rushing out, and then this is so funny to me. He tears it into pieces as one tears a young goat. And I'm like, exactly how does one tear a young goat? I feel like I'd need to do some working out before I could tear a young goat. And is that something that people just did? Oh, I think I'll go tear up a young goat for dinner. But apparently tearing up a young goat was something that was fairly easy for the average man. And so in comparison to that, that is what he does to this lion. Now, it does not appear that killing the lion is where he runs into trouble with regard to the dead body issue that we're going to look at in just a second. But it definitely does provide the story with a dead body. So he kills the lion, and this is intended to be an early sign of what God can do through him with the special strength that he is going to give him. And maybe you have had your own experience of this, where the Lord gives you sort of a dry run. Hey, you know what I could do with you? Be faithful in this small thing. And then, you know what? I'm going to give you a big thing. And so the lion is a test to him in one sense, because it is testing, hey, first of all, will you acknowledge where your strength came from? And then there are greater things that I can do from here. So let's see what happens with the lion. Notice this pattern that gets established at the end of verse 6. He tears apart the lion, and then it says, but he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And this is an interesting point here, because if you want to say, well, he's already defiled because he's touched a dead body, what should his next step have been? He should have gone to the tabernacle to be cleansed. So it appears that even if the issue is not that the lion is dead and he has touched it as he has killed it, the issue is that he's concealing it because he knows something is not right. He's already got something forming inside of him. Oh, I shouldn't tell anybody this happened. And this is something we've said again and again to our kids. Honesty is always better than concealment. Just tell us. You can't ever tell us something, and our reaction to that will be worse than if you hold it inside. And so he begins this pattern that some of you have known with your own children, some of you practiced yourself as a child with parents of, I think this needs to be hidden. And does that ever end well? No. And so let's see. It says, here we go in verse 7. Then he what? Went down. He's going down some more and talked with the woman. And she was right in Samson's eyes. So we have that repetition of, he's like, yeah, I told you, this is it, man. This is going to be awesome. Verse 8, after some days, he returned to take her. Don't you love the language we associate with getting yourself a wife? Wait till he calls her a heifer. And then it says, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. Okay, here we go. First, he sort of wanders close to the vineyards, and now what's he doing? I'm just going to see how that's going over there, and I'll just remember how awesome that was. So he turns aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey. Now, is this a usual thing, do you think? When you see roadkill on the side of the road, does it have a lovely little honeycomb inside and you just want to scoop your hand in there and get some of that? No, what is inside of it? Maggots and flies, right? So apparently, this is another miraculous thing here. This is another test from the Lord. There is the lion carcass. It has somehow miraculously desiccated in a way that is not disgusting to Samson at all. It houses something that is delicious. And so Samson, rather than say, oh, hold on a second, dead body alert, I better keep moving, what does he do? It says in verse 3, he scraped it out into his hands and went on eating as he went. Let me just get my hands all in that dead body. So he is unclean now because the lion is unclean. So if he was not unclean before, he certainly is now. And let's see what he does next. It says, and he came to his father and mother, and he gave some to them. Do you know what that means? They're unclean too. And she took the fruit, and she ate it, and she gave some to her husband. This is what we do with sin. We see it, we want it, we take it, we spread it. We see it, we want it, we take it, we spread it. And notice what he has done. This is such a vile thing because his parents have sanctified him his whole life, and he turns and desecrates them. This guy is up to no good, and he does not care. So it says he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate, but he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion. And the fact that he does not tell them tells us that he is aware that this is not okay, and he's doing it anyway. Why? Because it is right in his eyes. Starting verse 10, his father did what? Went down. His father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there. So the young men used to do, for so the young men used to do. Now this for so the young men used to do doesn't mean the young men of Israel. It means the young men of the Philistines. And so Samson is basically going to do as the Philistines do. And this term here, Samson prepared a feast. You know what the literal interpretation of that word feast is? A drinking party. That is what it literally translates to. A 7-day drinking party. So sure, maybe Samson sat over here and watched all of his new Philistine buddies get plowed. Or maybe not. Mr. Scrape the Honey out of a dead lion probably did not. The likelihood that he goes through a 7-day long bachelor party and does not partake seems pretty slim to me. So he has broken rule one of his Nazirite vow by touching a dead carcass, and now in all likelihood he has broken rule two by partaking of the fruit of the vine. So then everybody's been having a good time. Verse 11 says, as soon as the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him, because that was their thing. That was how the Philistines do things. And verse 12, and Samson said to them, let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And they said to him, put your riddle that we may hear it. So what is the deal that he's striking here? You're like, 30, is this 60 outfits? No, it's like 30 sets of underwear and 30 fancy clothes to go on top. And so this is a really, we pointed out in your homework, this is a very expensive request that he is making of them. And you'll see later when they can't complete the riddle that they begin to say, we're going to be impoverished if we can't figure out what this riddle means. And so it says, he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. And you and I are like, well, that's the easiest riddle ever, because we know, like we know about the lion, but he hasn't told anyone about the lion. So what has he done? He has just set up for these men an impossible riddle. There is no way that they can solve this riddle. Have you ever been around someone who gives you a riddle and then like stretches it out for days and won't tell you the answer? And what do you want to do? You want to punch that person in the face. Because what are they doing? They're self-elevating. They're like, I'm way smarter than you because you can't figure out my riddle. But this guy, in this case, is giving them a riddle that there is no way, unless they had been present, that they could figure out. Why? Because he wants their stuff. And what is the Lord doing through all of this? The Lord is working out his plan of bringing friction between the Philistines and Israel. So it says, and in 3 days they could not solve the riddle. Well, naturally, because they're not omniscient. Verse 15, on the fourth day they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is, or we're going to give you a really hard time. No, listen to what these guys say to this poor girl. Lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here to impoverish us? So this poor woman, do we even know if she wants to marry Samson in the first place? We do not. He does not sound particularly charming to me. And that hair has got to be a lot of upkeep. So here she is. She is placed between the proverbial rock and the hard place. And she basically had a death threat lodged against her and her family. Who do you think at this point she is more attached to, her family or Samson? Her family. She wants to save her family from her family, essentially, because these people who are her own people have threatened to kill them. And so verse 16 says, and Samson's wife wept over him and said, you only hate me, you do not love me, you have put a riddle to my people, and you have not told me what it is. And he said to her, behold, I have not told my father nor my mother, and shall I tell you? She wept before him the 7 days that their feast lasted, and on the 7th day he told her, because she pressed him hard. Then she told the riddle to her people. Now it's interesting to me that commentators portrayed her in many cases as the typical manipulative woman who is using tears and drama to extract this riddle from her husband. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, What the heck would you do if someone had threatened to kill your family? That wouldn't make you go to your husband and cry and beg him to tell you what the riddle was? So I think we see a woman here acting the way that any of us would act in her situation. She is trying to intercede for her family, and she's a Philistine. In some senses, she's behaving in a more righteous manner than the Israelite is. So she wept before him the 7 days that their feast lasted, and on the seventh day he told her because she pressed him hard. Then she told the riddle to her people. Verse 18, and the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? Oh, don't you know? That made him so mad because he had this quick two-liner that he was going to give to them. And who knows what they're going to think that it means. And now they come back and they indicate that they know the answer. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? And you know what the answer might be? There's so much irony in these phrases because if you look at what it is that Samson had said to them, he said, out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet, and they could have taken that to mean, and this is a little gross, but just think about what a drinking party is like. Out of the eater came something to eat. You've had 7 days of drinking and partying, and what happens when you overdrink? Out of the eater comes something to eat. And out of the strong comes something sweet. That could be a picture of Samson in some way, that he is going to marry this beautiful woman who he loves. But instead, they realize, no, that can't be it. And they come up with the right answer by cajoling his wife. And they say, what is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? And what would we say? Love is sweeter than honey. Love is stronger than a lion. Do you see there's all of this sort of marriage imagery that's woven in here, like it's supposed to be this beautiful thing, but it's not. It's this terrible thing. It's honey and it's a lion. And he says to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. Man, he just gets more and more charming, doesn't he? Now, what is the point of if you had not plowed with my heifer? A heifer was not an animal that was used for plowing. It does not soften the fact that he refers to his wife as a heifer. It is as unflattering in the original language as it sounds to you in English. But he is saying, you have misused me. You never should have gone to my wife and put her to the test on this. To which I would say, what on earth were these men supposed to do? And so he says that they cheated. That is what he says. But who is it that cheated in the first place? The one who set up a riddle that no one could possibly solve so that he could gain these 30 garments. Verse 19, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. And he went, now that's interesting, right? Because the Spirit of the Lord has rushed upon him. Why? Because the Lord is working through sinful Samson to incite friction between Israel and the Philistines. So despite the fact that Samson has made terrible self-serving choices, the Lord's Spirit still comes upon him. The Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down. There's the last one. Went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. So what does he do? He goes and kills 30 innocent men. Relatively speaking, yes, they're Philistines, but are they in any way attached to what has gone on in Timnah? No. And so he goes and he strikes down these 30 men. He takes their clothing and their spoil, and he gives the garments to those who had told the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his best man. So the fact that Samson's wife is given to his companion who had been his best man tells us that what did this family expect from Samson? Was he ever coming back? No. And at this point, they're just trying to save face. And so they give his heifer to his best man. Because what else can they do at this point? And that's where we get what we all hate to see when we're watching our favorite show on TV. The little words pop up and it says, to be continued. Dun, dun, dun. And you have to wait. You have to wait until next week to find out how God is going to continue to use Samson in spite of himself to incite conflict with the Philistines. But what have we seen already? We have seen this pattern of Samson does what Samson wants to do, but behind all of it, the Lord is going to do what the Lord wants to do. Samson is a man of great strength. He is a man of supernatural physical strength, but he lacks the most important form of strength of all. He lacks moral strength. He lacks spiritual strength. And he is going to rely on his outward strengths and not worry at all about his inward ones. What about you and me? Because what are the things that will win us the praise of man? They're those outward things, those things that make us look awesome. It's the dreadlocks and the feats of strength that draw people to us to worship us. And they won't know. No one will know the state of our heart. You know me, and you probably think of me as basically a moral person because you come and sit and listen to me teach the Bible every week, but you don't know me. Only the Lord knows my heart for real. The scriptures tell us that we don't even know our own hearts. Above all, the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Jeremiah 17:9. Not even the owner of the heart can see the depths of the deception that lives there. Only the Lord knows the heart. And yet we spend all of our time worrying about whether we look good, about whether what we're doing is right in our own eyes. And Samson should remind us, are you looking for the fruit of the Spirit to come upon you, to be made manifest inside of you in ways that the world may never look at and celebrate? You know, it takes us a long time to realize that someone has been incredibly patient with us over a period of years. Maybe you have a parent who was patient with you over a period of years while you worked out your Samsonite kinks. You know, the people who are the most fruitful in the Spirit, the people who are long-suffering and who are gentle and who are gracious and who are kind, those are not always the people that we gravitate to and celebrate, because these are gifts that often we only recognize in hindsight. And so we have a tendency, like Samson, to say, more feats of strength, more things that are going to draw attention to me, more things that are going to put me in a position of power. And here's what we're going to see as we move through next week, but we've already seen it introduced this week, is that Samson is providing for us a metaphor of the nation of Israel as a whole. And think about this, because the nation of Israel from its birth, you could even say before its birth, if you want to date the nation of the birth of Israel to the Exodus, okay, when they pass through water and blood, moving out into the wilderness, if you want to call that their birth narrative, then you can trace all the way back to Father Abraham that these people were to be set apart from birth until when? Until the end. They were to be set apart. And yet, rather than remaining set apart, Israel behaves as Samson behaves. They seek to fraternize and live among pagans. They take on this prevailing culture and become undiscernible from what is going on around them. And we'll see the rest of how this metaphor is going to play out next week. This is a chilling metaphor for us, because anything that is pointing us to truths about Israel is also pointing us to truths about ourselves. How much do we just want to look like everyone around us? How much do we want to intermarry, maybe not literally, but in a metaphorical sense? How much do we want to make ourselves a part of what everyone else is doing and not worry so much about the commands of the Lord? Think how hard it would have been to have maintained a Nazarite vow. Really, think about how hard that would have been, even under the best circumstances where you're around other people who understand what you're doing and are supportive of what you're doing. It's Lent right now. Did anybody give anything up? How's that going? Like, when I give things up for Lent, I usually make it to the end of Lent, but I am so cranky about it the whole time. It's hard to do something different than everyone else is doing. And when we're doing something different than everyone else is doing, have you noticed how hard it is for people to not tell you what they gave up for Lent? Anybody else on social media? And that's fine. Like, I don't think it's by definition wrong to be like, hey, by the way, everyone, I gave up from this. Although we do have some words about fasting in the New Testament and not letting everybody know. I think there is an aspect in which it can be giving an example to others. And then there is an aspect in which it can be self-promoting. And because I don't know your heart, I'm not going to spend time trying to decide which one you chose when you put it on Facebook. I got enough trouble with my own heart. But the point is this. Think how hard it is to be set apart if you take a Nazarite vow. Now consider that as the children of God, we have all been called to be set apart. And that there are implications that are internal that go along with that. But honestly, there are external ones as well. Just as with the Nazarite vow, you could look among the Jewish community and go, that guy took a vow for the Lord. Ought we not to look that way in the culture in which we dwell?
Ought there not to be discernible things about us and the choices we make regarding our entertainment and the way that we spend our money and the way that we spend our time and the way that we raise our children, in the way that we relate to our aging parents, in the way that we participate in the things that other people participate in? Shouldn't there be something that sets us apart? May we not be like Samson, those who do what is right in our own eyes, because when we do that, we will without doubt do what is right in the eyes of the majority. The easiest thing, the thing that makes much of us. And so I think that as we wait with to be continued, what we can already take from this story is, how is the Lord asking you to be set apart this week, this year, this decade? For some of us, it's this afternoon. How would the Lord have you be salt and light in a culture that is not salty and dwells in darkness? How would the Lord have you look at the example of Samson and say, I want to seek after the will of the Lord internally and externally in a way that brings light into darkness? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for these first two chapters of the Samson cycle. We pray, Lord, that we would pay close attention so that we can learn and choose differently. And Father, above whatever we can take from Samson's example, we look to your role in this story, and we rejoice that you are able to bring beauty from ashes, and not the ashes that someone else's fire caused, but the ashes of the fires that we ourselves have set. We confess to you that we are fire starters, that we are those who seek after our own good, independent of what you might have to say about it. And we pray, Lord, that both in our growing in holiness and in the places where we still fall short, you would be magnified. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.